Everybody talks about me when I'm not here. I understand.
Oh, Deco, I'm curious. Deco's up in New Hampshire. I saw them recently. Deco, if you are on, let us know what you guys do.
I got my mug.
I don't even have a mug. How does that work?
I bought mine. I wanted it.
Oh, that's funny.
Saraya has all of the mugs. I got a sample of every mug just to have, and then she wanted to make some content out of it, so she has all of my mugs. But we will get Mike a mug, and I'll get a mug. But so today we're going to cover MBTA. We can chit chat some more, but we're going to cover MBTA Communities Act, the 10th edition, where we're at with that. Hopefully you found out yesterday, Mike. Probably not, because we were both both busy. Municipal job openings and EV chargers that were voted on to go on Boston public streets. So that's what we cover today. But how did Boston Irish Construction need a mug too? So we'll make sure they get one. How did it go last night with the energy class?
I went pretty well. Again, so, you know, as I call it, it's the energy roadshow. Everybody's kind of, you know, it's been out there since the middle of this past year, and it's just slowly starting to affect construction now, meaning it's affecting the way people build, right, in the way people are designing projects. So I think there's an interesting tie-in to when we start talking about MBTA communities and affordable housing and people who are, you know, eligible to build, and now that we have a new energy code on the street, what, you know, what's the potential for somebody to build affordable now that, you know, I don't want to be a naysayer, but at the same time, there are people that are a little bit leery about, you know, construction and having to comply with, whether it be fossil fuel free or comply with, you know, significant requirements for renewable energy. So there's an interesting mix of regulations out and about these days.
Yes, and what you're alluding to, they affect the cost of construction and that ties to affordable built homes. It ties to just making any project work, right?
Yeah, and I know the studies are out there, and so, you know, the way I look at it, and interestingly enough, the contractor that I taught at yesterday does a lot of affordable housing developments with a particular developer, with a particular property manager, and these people are, you know, are building affordable and are building energy compliant or energy code compliant. But you know, I know there are a lot of you know, there's a lot of data out there that says that, you know, look, the energy code is not costing people that much money. But the fact is, if you look at construction and how it's changing construction, and I don't know enough about the economics, I'll tell you that, I'll be 100% honest. I don't know enough about the economics of it, but I do know that the appliances and that the fixtures and that the construction type is more costly than it was previous. That's what I do know, right? Mm-hmm. So I just don't, I'd like to see more of like that MIT and Wentworth study on a larger scale to show what is the effect of going fossil fuel free. Right? What is the effect on development? What is the effect on somebody who's building affordable units? You know, them now, if they have to take a hit on the units themselves because they're only getting, you know, X amount of money on their return, now they're building energy compliant to this energy code and they're paying the money up front for energy compliance. Like, what is the effect on development? I don't know if you want to comment, Joe, on the comment that was made at a recent meeting about people putting shovels in the ground soon.
Yeah, I don't know if I want to say that publicly, but yeah, I mean, there's some concern from a lot of groups that, you know, we're not going to be breaking ground this year. And a big part of that is the energy code. And, you know, when Joe Sway, good morning, Ben, good morning. You know, I'm wearing the Wentworth sweatshirt today because they're going to be on the parade float with us on Saturday trying to get people into this business. So we obviously want more people building. But the Wentworth and MIT study was hyper conservative about the cost increase. You know, I mean, they came out, I want to say around 3.5% when they studied it. And, you know, they were taking fire from all sides about how such bad people they were, this and that. And they're like, listen, we're just looking at the data. And because they were trying not, understanding it was a somewhat touchy subject, they were hyper conservative at 3.5%. And then when I shared that info, I had quite a few contractors and developers reach out and say that number is low. Considerably low. And they gave good numbers. They gave jobs that were priced before and after the energy code.
Yep.
One was a national builder that had, you know, real good data, that, you know, they're not messing around. They need to know what real costs are because they're dealing with billions and billions of dollars.
Yep.
So those groups looked at it and they said that, you know, MIT Wentworth said that the 3.5% increase, that's, I'm paraphrasing, but the market itself is saying it's much, much more. And what you were alluding to was, you know, some of that knows pretty well and says that, you know, we're not breaking ground on a lot of or almost any projects this year, and that's because of the energy code. So yeah, that's a huge issue, but it seems like it's being well received. Like, you know, you were out last night doing that energy class, couple other companies this week, and then receiving follow-ups from those companies, and they're like, hey, you know, what about some additional training on passive house, because passive house is a one of the pathways, right?
Well, it's slowly becoming, and even out of the stretch code, the one of the pathways for commercial properties does not say passive code, but it's a parallel pathway to passive house. So the principles are alive in other pathways for compliance, but passive house is the only large multifamily, like the podium buildings in 31 communities right now, which are the opt-in communities. So if you have a large podium building over 12,000 square feet or a large residential building, that's the only pathway you can follow in the state right now is passive house. So there's 31 communities that are affected by that right now. I shouldn't say affected. That's a negative connotation. So 31 communities that have to comply with that right now.
Comply, is that any better?
I don't know.
You must comply.
I don't know. Every time I teach the energy code, as I said, you know, interestingly enough, I've probably done this about 15, a dozen times over the past year, 6 months even. And I think, the National Association of Electrical Contractors was very receptive, thought this was great. Obviously we're moving towards electrification, and most people are kind of, I think it's, we talked about electrification for years, we talked about stricter energy codes, and it just kind of crept up on everybody and bang, now it's here and it's the law, right? So I think everybody's the one thing that gets everybody is a particular municipality has in their regulation for fossil fuel free, and this is what gets the most feedback. In as of 2035, and that's the year they put down, as of 2035 there will be no more fossil fuel permits for commercial restaurants.
That's crazy.
So no more gas permits, no more fossil fuels allowed in commercial restaurants. So that's the, I had people tell me there would be blood in the streets if their pizza had to go through an electric oven. So it should be interesting.
All right. Well, another, we won't say, no, this is a law.
That's
right?
A good question. Boston Irish, does Mass have the infrastructure to cope with all the new electric in structures, right?
Oh yeah, we don't. That's someone that I think we'll have to bring into the main show, is to for someone to walk through capacity of the grid and, you know, what does it mean for electrification? What does it mean for availability of power? What does it mean for cost? Regina and I were talking about this a little while ago, and, you know, New York has just reset their rates because utility is regulated.
Yep.
So they have to come to an agreement with the state of Massachusetts about the cost. And New York just had a huge increase in costs, and we are looking to negotiate. So even though our electricity costs have been going up
steadily. We're looking at potentially another large jump. Recently, when we had Scott Van Boris on, he talked about a lot of this wind that we were counting on, wind power. But what happened was, and this was kind of fascinating to me, which was windmills are looked at just like any other real estate development. And I guess when you think about it, it makes sense, but they look at it and say, okay, what's it going to cost me to build this? What are my carrying costs? What's my return on investment? And with interest rates going up, it tanked a bunch of wind projects that were supposed to be providing electricity to us, because the developers looked at it and they said, this doesn't work. They went back to the governing body and said, hey, we need to have you pay us more for this electricity to make this work. And they're like, no, we can't do that. It's already gone up too high. So then it tanked those windmill projects.
Right.
So, I mean, it's in a bad way. And, you know, I would love to have somebody on that can really talk about this. I mean, a lot of it's anecdotal. Like I had somebody talk about a customer of theirs that was looking to switch their fleet to put like 8 vehicles, I think it was construction equipment, to electric. And when they went to the town, it was a town that had their own utility for electric. And the town looked at them like they were insane.
Right.
They're like, you can't have that much power. They're like, the whole town doesn't use that much power.
Right.
We don't have that.
Right.
You know, and I'm not being overdramatic. Literally, the town did not use as much power as they wanted to bring to their building to charge all their construction equipment.
Right.
So, yeah, we definitely need someone with some expertise in to talk. I think it'd be a great subject.
And I think that's a good segue. It's going to be out of order here, but Reggie, you have that information on the electric stove?
Yes.
Conversion?
So two things. I mean, back to National. So I received an email from National Grid last week saying that like the rates were going to go up starting October 1st for the next 5 years. And there's, I think, like public hearings. And so, I know we talked about New York a little bit, but they're sending out notifications here, Mass, to expect increases. And, I have a condo that is a heat pump and electric heat pump, and the prices are astronomical. I mean, the whole building itself, it's just everyone complains every year about the heat and the cost that it really does, you know, have on the consumer, which, you know, and now if they're, so anyway, so to your point, one, you know, National Grid, I received an email from them last week about increases, and then Boston did recently receive, I saw an article in the Globe, $1 million federally funded to change 80 gas stoves over to electric in Codman Square. So, you know, that's happening through Boston Housing right now. And it just seems like more and more this is just the way that it's going to go, and the prices are going up. So,
but even that, right? Like, even changing over electric stoves, that's not just like you put an outlet in and plug the stove in, right? Yeah. So that building has to have the capacity, if it's one building or if it's to put those
two buildings.
Okay. But so they have to have the capacity, and if they don't have the capacity, you know, they have to go ahead and add the capacity to that building for the, I mean, stoves are an interesting thing anyway, when you think about it, because they don't have to be vented, and we do burn gas in a house, right? So it's an interesting concept anyway. But, you know, you have to have the capacity in order to do that changeover. And what is that going to mean for them in the long run, as far as now providing an upgrade to the service or whatever they have to do to provide, you know, if it's two buildings and it's 40 each building, what is a electric stove is, what, a 210 or a 220, whatever it is, somebody can chime in on the, but you know, it's more capacity now that they add in.
Yeah. But Mike, it brings up a good point, because when I was sitting in on one of your classes, you were talking about the demonstration code, not only not allowing you to use fossil fuels, but then also putting a cap on the amount of electrical that can be used.
Right.
So,
right.
You know, great, K&B contractor, 50, thank you. 50
and 220.
So you do a 6-unit building with 50 amp electric stoves in each unit, like That's substantial.
Yeah.
Right. You might need to do a service upgrade.
Right. And you know, I don't want to be the grim reaper here. It seems like we're piling on, but
no,
this is,
go for
we're
it.
Just talking fact, right?
Yeah.
Procuring electrical services, equipment, panels is not the easiest thing right now, right? If anybody's been on, Reggie, you've probably seen it, you know, with your projects in the field, and even single family homeowners are now installing 400 amp panels in a single family in order to accommodate the electrical in future electrical, right?
Yeah.
Which to go on and finish up with what you just mentioned, Joe, is all this electrification doesn't mean you can just be willy-nilly and use as much electric as you can. Like Passive House, for instance, is going to limit the electrical usage per square foot, right? They're going to give you a kilowatt per square foot number, right? This is how many kilowatts you can use per square foot. Yeah. So it's not just going out and saying, okay, everybody on the electrical grid. So they're going to limit it, but it's still a demand. There is going to be a demand, and the demand has to be supplied, and the supply has to come from somewhere.
Yeah.
So. And like Ross and Irish are saying, you know, obviously we need to build tighter buildings to make this, to make this happen. And I, for one, get slightly concerned when we go to, like, when you have people that are passive house builders and they really know what they're doing. Like, the people that are doing it now are probably, you know, on the cutting edge. They're like the first movers. They're super into this, and they're looking at all the different, like, you look at, the guys that just built the Mass Timber in Roxbury. I can't believe I'm forgetting their name.
Hacon.
Hacon, thank you. You look at Patrick from Hacon. Like, he's building passive house stuff, and his knowledge of systems is excellent. His attention to detail is excellent. I have no doubt that, help me, Mike. Hacon.
You need more coffee.
Yeah, I do need more coffee. I have no doubt that Hacon's passive house projects are spot on, and they're going to work like they're supposed to. But when the energy code pushes so many people to build passive house, now we're looking for, you know, Joe or Jane Blow with a pickup truck to understand all these systems and make sure we're doing it just right. Because if you're not, it's a system. And if one piece of that system is off, just like a rated wall, if you have a 2-hour rated wall, but you put a 30-minute door in the thing, you don't have a 2-hour rated wall. It's a system. And if we're not doing that system in the style of passive house correct, you have one thing wrong, you have a little bit of flashing wrong, and now we have moisture in the wall, you don't have the ability for moisture escape. Like, I think there's, you know, everything has to hit just right for this plan to work.
Right.
And, you know, I'm afraid that, you know, not everything is going to hit right, and then we're going to be facing a lot of problems. Because, you know, Regina's talking about the stove and $1 million from the feds here and grants from other places and rebates. So there's all this money underwriting this, because currently it doesn't work financially. So we need to underwrite it with government money, for lack of a better word. But what happens when that money goes away? You know, and
right.
We're left with, you know, potentially not enough electricity and extremely high costs. And that's a concern. I would, you know, I'd love to have somebody on the other side that tells me how that works. I mean, like, I know I've had Mark Scow on a couple times on the main show, and, you know, he's great, you know, and he understands how all these systems work. And, you know, he believes that, you know, when we do these things, that in the long run, this is going to play out and we're going to be in a much better place. So,
yep.
I would love to have him on. And I'd also like to have somebody on that can speak about the grid. So anybody that's listening, please, if that's you, let me know, and we can chat about that. But why don't we, while we're talking on the energy, why don't we, it was supposed to be the last one, but why don't we roll into EV chargers? So City Council just voted to approve the plan to hire 2 contractors to install 250 EV chargers on the streets of Boston.
Yeah.
The opposite side of that are the people that saying, okay, it's difficult to park already. The goal of the city is to have an EV charger within a 10-minute walk of every resident. But I think we start running into problems. Like, I'm curious, like, where this would even go. Would it be like a parking meter?
Right.
Would it go right on?
There's not many meters left.
I know.
They've already eliminated many of the meters.
And is it going to be limited in time? Like, what's the...
Well, that was an interesting note that I made. So it says that you can only park there while you're charging.
Yeah, I saw that.
But how does that get enforced?
Right. If your car is fully charged, who's got? Are they monitoring if your car is fully charged? I mean, is there a sensor on the? Does the charger actually tell the charger itself tell you if the car is charged? And then if you're in eating at a restaurant, and your car finishes charging. Do you have to go move the car if it's finished charging?
Great point.
I see. So Target near me has the Tesla chargers, and people just sit in the cars for hours.
Right.
Like you see them just sitting in their vehicles while they're charging.
Funny enough, Amazon sells a thing that you can put on a truck or a car that looks like a charging port that you can plug the charger into, but it's not actually charging. So it looks like so you can utilize those spots closer to the store or the restaurant.
I love it. Boston Irish Construction says they can take power from the street lighting.
So. Yeah.
Well, they have those little solar panels on top of the street lights now too. So maybe
So I'm curious, how many cars in the city are actually electric? Like, how many people be using this that are City of Boston residents?
I have no idea.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
But I mean, I just think trying to police when that charger is done, right? So you pull up, it's now a City of Boston charger. One interesting thing is they said the two, I was reading into it, it was hard to tell for sure. I don't know who the two contractors that are going to install these chargers are, but the money goes to the companies that installed the chargers. So it sounds like those contractors are going to pay to install the chargers curbside. They get the money that the people pay when they're charging, and they're saying if there's excess of a certain amount, that money goes back to the city. But if I'm owning those chargers and someone's parked in it and sitting there, like, I'm going to want BTD to go write that person a ticket. I'm going to be all over them because I'm right.
I know, I agree, but like, good luck having that happen.
You know, stopping me from making a profit. The agreement that we had with the city, I want to read Brad's comment.
Melrose has charges on the telephone poles, utility poles. We don't want to offend the utility companies. It's utility poles. I was chastised before for calling them a telephone pole by an electrical inspector.
I love it. Brad, if you don't mind, is it on the street side of the pole or on the sidewalk side? I'm just thinking, if it's on the street side, is it bulging out into the space? But back to the point about, okay, so the city is contracting with these two companies to put in 250 sidewalk chargers. They are underwriting this whole thing with the idea that they'll get the money back when people are charging and they'll collect those fees. If that's the agreement I have with the city, then I'm going to say to the city, listen, we have an agreement here. You have to get these cars out when they're done because you're preventing us from making the money that we agreed
right.
to. So, you know, how does that get police into your point, Mike? Like, what do you got to, you know, wait on the sidewalk and say, okay, it's done. Let me jump in and move my car. It seems logistically to be a challenge. And so let's see what Brad said. Street side, it's up high and out of the way. Okay, great. So you can kind of drive.
He added the utility in there. I'm sorry, Brad. I was yelled at. Yeah. I just like, because I was made fun of, I like to call it out. But so here's another thing. Isn't like Tesla charging, their charger is proprietary, meaning a Tesla charging handle can only be put into a Tesla vehicle, right?
So it's they're going to a universal standard, and I think they might even be adopting the Tesla one. That was just within the last year. So that problem should go away. But so now it goes on a utility pole, and I'm sorry, Brad, we got to keep asking you. Maybe if you're, wave at me if you're interested in coming on, because we can pull you in here. But how is that getting fed? So they're just coming off a, you know, a sidewalk vault or the street and coming, you know, cutting the asphalt and concrete and then stubbing up through the sidewalk. That's what, you know, I would be curious how that is. And then, you know, who's, if that's the case, you're going to have, you know, EverSource of the utility out on the street working and probably making the tie-ins, and then the EV company takes it once it stubs up through the sidewalk or terminates it into the charger. The logistics on this are going to be interesting. What else did I want to say about that? So 10-minute walk, park while charging, money will go to the installers, overflows to the city. The other interesting thing on this is Cambridge is trying to offer sidewalk mats. So what was happening was people wanting to park their cars on the street and plug in, but obviously everyone's seen those charger cords, which are quite large, and they were getting fines from, you know, I don't know what the code enforcement mechanism was for sidewalks, but they were getting fined. And then City of Cambridge is now, I believe, offering these mats that, so you now can run the cord across the sidewalk and it's accessible, meets the accessibility code. So, and I don't know where you go get these mats, but this is all going to be a challenge.
Yeah, especially in the winter, when if they have a bunch of these mats out down a street and trying to clear the sidewalks. I mean, again, not to be naysayers, but there's, you know, the infrastructure. The big thing here is the infrastructure for all these electrical upgrades are, you know, fossil fuel free upgrades, if you want to say. The infrastructure is just not there. We're not at that point that we can accommodate all of this electrical change at this time, right? It's kind of like, you know, we got to pass it to see what's in it. And I think that's what happened, is we passed regulation and we're moving towards this regulation without putting in the building blocks, so to speak, to accommodate all of this. So, but.
Hey, Reg, is a former East Boston resident, you know, what's your take on like parking in general, taking away, you know, I mean, if 250 spots, so maybe it's only, you know, if you were to say Eastie, what is there, maybe 10 or 15 of these things that go in there, maybe 20, pull away 20 parking spots?
I mean, I really think, you know, certain neighborhoods would be greatly affected. And just, you know, I still spend a lot of time in East Boston and the city itself, and parking's been a challenge. I mean, they just have found, I feel like the city has found every reason to eliminate parking in the city, and with no way of replacing it. They want you to take bikes or public transportation, whatever it might be, and bus lanes. You know, the South End has been greatly affected where my office is, in terms of parking being removed, both, you know, meters, residential, South Boston. I mean, if you think of some of these neighborhoods, you know, where I grew up in East Boston, I don't know how much of it would really be affected in that my particular neighborhood, but down Jeffrey's Point, Day Square, I mean, people are already fighting for parking spots as it is. I think it just, throughout the city, I think it's a problem.
Yeah.
How many more spots are you going to take away? People do still drive their cars. You know, there are, you know, a lot of people that don't rely on public transportation to get around. And I think it's an issue.
I think it's by design, right?
Of course. That's how I feel.
Like,
same way.
If the parking is going away, right, and people are realizing, look, there's no place to park, it's going to force them to find alternative transportation to get to that space, right? So it's a it's a double-edged. Planning, town planning, city planning is moving towards no parking, less parking, parking reductions for developments anyway, right? So I think it's, you know, municipalities saying, well, we don't want to fix the problem because if we don't have the parking, you're going to force people to utilize alternatives, right? Like why? I don't know. Well, I somewhat know why, but, you know, talking about East Boston, we just had two projects there in the past 6 months probably, and I had to go to site visits. It took me longer to find a parking space than the site visit took, right? But why, like New York, you drive down the streets in New York, parking is a premium in New York, but how many stackers and how many parking areas do they have that are vertically stacked, right? And we just never, we never got into that here in the city. You see them here and there, you see the parking systems going in garages now, but you don't see, you don't see stackers in parking lots that often.
Yeah, and here's the thing, I think where the flaw with that plan, if that is the plan from an urban planning standpoint, which is put the systems in place. Like I would, if there was great public transportation, I would love to take it, right? Like, you know, I spent some time in a semester in England, and it was a suburban, maybe slash small city.
Right.
And I used the bus all the time. I have a bus at the end of my street here in West Roxbury. I would never in a million years get on that bus.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's just not convenient.
You don't know where you're going.
It's not reliable. Convenient. It's not reliable.
Right. Yeah. Right.
And just like the options that it gives me is so little. And to like, I would love it if I could simply get on public transportation and get to East Boston to do the site visit.
Yeah.
I would jump at that opportunity. I would love that. So I think the plan is rather than, you know, make it so difficult to drive that you have to take public transportation, why don't we make public transportation good enough that people want to take public transportation?
Yeah.
I think that's the route.
Well,
hang on, I gotta let David.
That's the, I've said this, I've done a little bit of traveling over the past couple of years.
You have, really?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm just amazed in Europe how great the transportation is. I don't even speak the language, right? So the first place we went, Portugal. I don't speak Portuguese, but I was able to get to about 10 different towns on public transportation, you know, just by utilizing their maps and asking somebody, okay, what line should we be on? You know, Italy and Germany, they have 50 different track lines that go to all different, they have local, they have, you know, regional, and then they have international train lines. And I was still able to find the location we were going and what, it's interesting. You know, it is interesting to see how it works there and it just doesn't work here.
I just want, Boston Irish's construction is hopping off, but you know, thanks for hopping on. You were helpful. Thanks for the input.
Yeah, thanks.
We love that. And yeah, we'll talk to him. I'll send you a message. Yeah, so I mean, I want to get back to the dollars and cents of that. Like you talk about doing those site visits in East Boston, right? And the time it takes to park. Now, if it becomes worse and we take public transportation, and now I'm not being, you know, bombastic here, and it takes an extra 4 hours, no joke, to get to East Boston via public transportation, how much of an upgrade is that going to cost to the work we're doing?
Right.
You know, throw another $1,000 on everything because that's what it's going to take to get there. So everybody gets charged an extra $1,000. And that's how when someone's like, why are construction costs going through the roof? Well, you just keep stacking regulations on top of everything and you keep stacking fees. Like, yeah, let's burn the fucking place down. Like you look at Somerville and you know they're tacking on a third of a percent for a safety review on a permit.
Oh yeah, 30%
on the total cost of construction. That is a huge number.
The fees in Somerville, they're the highest in the state and they're completely outrageous.
The permit fees, Reggie,
the permit fees, and like to Joe's point, so the permit fees are already high. And then during COVID, they added on a safety review, and they do have safety offices that now go out. But I mean, it is, their fees are astronomical, and they will tell you that they're the highest in the state.
Right.
They are.
Yep. I
But
mean,
Joe,
yeah.
excuse me, so back to the point, I mean, about East Boston and public transportation being so poor, I don't think a lot of people are taking the train. What they're going to do is they're going to hop in an Uber, which is going to cause more congestion on the streets, right? So it's, they're trying to force us to not use vehicles, so to speak, but then people are just jumping in an Uber, right? So it's, and then with tunnel closures and all that other stuff, I mean, this summer they're shutting the tunnel down again. They did that last summer. So.
Yeah. And I mean, and I think it goes back to what I was saying before, which is like, how much money is getting invested in preventing people from driving? Invest that money in making fantastic
Public
transportation. I wish I
transportation.
had,
Right.
I've got a bus in West Roxbury that does nothing for me. Like I said, it's literally down the end of my street, and I never use it. And I would love a T-stop in West Roxbury. I'd be thrilled. It would probably be great for my property value. Like, if there was better systems here that could get you quickly or relatively quickly. I'm not even talking, just reasonable, just not like, okay, I have to wait because bus service is, spotty. And then I'm standing out there, and then I have to take the bus to Forest Hills, and then from Forest Hills to Downtown Crossing, and then from Downtown Crossing, get on the blue line and go to East Bo like,
Forget it. Like, you
nobody
don't
can
even
do
want to
that.
come here. Why would you even want to come
Yeah.
here?
So,
Ricky Prendergast just signed on.
Oh, he's
He can
Ricky
tell us
Rowe.
about the transportation in Ireland.
Yeah, there we go.
He's at the
Well,
probably at the airport waiting to jump his flight here.
awesome. And Justin, welcome, Justin and Charlie. We see a lot of
Hey, Charlie.
new faces. But yeah, so all this effort that's being put into bike lanes and now EV, sidewalk EV chargers and
We got bus
yeah, and
lanes.
bus lanes, and like we have our road diet here in West Roxbury. Like, there's a lot of effort and a lot of money put into, creating these other pathways and making it more challenging for cars. But why don't we just invest all that money and make a great public transportation? And then, like I said, I would jump at the opportunity to not have to get in a car and drive through. Like, think I want to drive from West Roxbury to East Boston in a car? Rather gouge my eyes out, but like, I have no choice. I'd much rather sit on a train and do some work. A lot of times I'm taking Uber anyway because I'm like, well, it's going to take me an hour. This is true story. Often I say it's going to take me an hour or an hour and a half to get somewhere. I'm going to take an Uber. I can open up my
And you
laptop
work.
and then at least make some money on the way there rather than losing all that time. So, yeah.
I want to say one more thing though. Even with all of the new infrastructure that they've made, it's so confusing sometimes, like how to just navigate around like the bus lane, the bike lane. Even for like, I know some new teenage drivers, and I'm like, I feel bad for these kids. Like, it's so confusing to act like, can you drive down the lane? Can you not? How do you
Right.
get around? It's
Right.
not easy to navigate. And we've been driving for 25 years,
Yeah. I mean, when you're taking a right-hand turn in the bus lane is the entirety of the right-hand lane. One of the spaces is Government Center, where they're taking down the Government Center garage. And you have the city market, the Haymarket, the interior market there. There's a bus lane on the right-hand side outside of Haymarket Station. But everybody needs to take a right to go towards the north end. And there's cars speeding up there, there's buses. Can you take the right? You can only take a right there. Now you can actually take a left back up towards Cambridge Street. But yeah,
To be certain
it's
now is it shouldn't be 24/7, in my opinion, but
yeah. And I mean, I would love to see some good urban planning really look at this. It seems like we just kind of hodgepodge, try and change things here and there, and it's not cohesive. Like, even just, going back, Mike, talking about travel, like, I went to Iceland. They had a great biking system in there in Reykjavik, where people could get around. It was just, I was like, this is great. I would want to ride my bike. I would like to ride my bike places. I would love to, but
Right.
like, I'm
I mean,
concerned about Center Street. Like, I wouldn't want to drive down Center Street even with the bike lanes because I'm going to get doored because the bike lane has the door that opens up into it, and they supposedly have a little loading zone there, but everybody parks in the loading zone.
Like, right.
So this might sound crazy because we did talk about East Boston already, but you know, even this summer when the tunnel was shut down, yes, so we had, they had the MBTA shuttle, what is it called? The boat. I'm not using the proper term,
yeah,
but
yeah, yeah.
What about if they created a bridge or some way from East Boston to downtown or Charlestown so people could take their bikes? You can't take your bike through the tunnel,
right?
So if you do take your bike, so they're creating these bike lanes, and now we're getting all into the bike lanes, but then you get down to Maverick and you're sort of stuck, so you have to go on the blue line. It would be nice, you know, thinking of the infrastructure, why don't they create something that you can ride your bike from East Boston to the other side of the city?
Yeah, that'd be great.
You know, back to the urban planning.
Right, right.
We're getting late, and I want to hit MBTA community back. So this is a good tie-in because, you know, we're talking about trying to improve MBTA infrastructure so people want to use it. And in Massachusetts, there is the MBTA Communities Act. And for people that don't know, the law that says, you know, this is kind of, I think, the first time really, I mean, this 40, Mike, you would know better than me with 40A and 40B.
Yeah.
But this is the first time in a long time that the state has stepped in and is putting their hand on the scale to some degree of zoning in local communities.
Yeah.
So what it says is if you have a rapid transit in, or you're part of an MBTA community, which includes something that has a commuter rail, subway, ferry. So if you're down Route 3 and you've got a ferry, you're now an MBTA community, or bus station. I was surprised. I didn't realize it was going to include bus stations as well.
Right.
So if you are any of those, you need to change the zoning within, let me get the numbers right, within a half mile of one of those stations. You have to have a minimum gross density of 15 units per acre. You can have no age restrictions on it. And so what it's saying is you have to allow for density around any of these public transportation stations. And it needs to be a 50-acre area, and it needs to be within a half mile of the stop.
Right.
So you don't have to have it right on top of it, but within that half mile, you have to have a zoning district that meets those rules.
Yep.
Now, what's happening?
A little bit of a revolt.
Yep.
Yeah, a little bit of revolt. Like Milton and Wrentham just voted not to comply.
Wrentham did too.
Yeah,
I think Brentham did. Yeah. And then you have communities like Newton that are what I would say is creatively not complying.
Mm-hmm.
So no, the regulation doesn't say that you have to build this housing. It just says you have to change your zoning rule.
Right.
So go ahead, Mike.
No, I'm just... I'm doing my best, Joe. Here, I'm doing my best not to jump in.
Chime in, because I don't want to dominate. I just want to lay the groundwork.
There's a lot to unwrap here that people don't understand, right? So 40B has been in effect since the early 70s and the late 60s, like 1960 something, which is every community has to have 10% of their housing stock affordable, right? And the affordability is based on the community, not based on a state factor. It's based on the community. So that's been in effect. And, you know, I would say 99% of those projects, I'm throwing that arbitrarily, are pushed away because they get to skirt zoning for 40B. So if you provide 20% of the units in a 40B project affordable, you get to build bigger. You get to build more units, right? So that's the allowance. And then what people don't realize is about 5 or 6 years ago, Massachusetts zoning changed in an effort to go to its as-of-right multifamily housing. And I think it stumbled because there was no teeth to it. But basically, when you pass a zoning ordinance, and I'm going way around here, but to show you where this has gone and why we've gotten to this. When you pass a zoning ordinance, historically, it has to be usually a two-thirds vote of town meeting, right, in order to pass in the town a zoning ordinance, right? So a bunch of years back, they changed it to say anything to do with multifamily housing is only a majority vote of your town, right, to move to it that. And back in 14 or 15, they said you have to have areas in your town that are as of right multifamily housing, but it never had any teeth to it. So now you fast forward, we have the MBTA Communities Act, and now they're essentially trying to force on communities, here's where your multifamily housing is going to be, right? Here's where your commuter-based housing is going to be. And I think people are just like, you know, look, even a progressive town like Newton, who, you know, is historically, you know, been on the surface a friend of affordable housing, but you know, they've just said no, right? They've just said we don't want to do it. They didn't say no. They, like you said, they were very creative about it. But interesting about Newton, not to go too far into this, Newton had a problem with the fossil fuel free code because they did not meet the affordable housing threshold, which was one of the criteria for the to be in the fossil fuel free program. So again, I just talked around a little bit of fact there, but there's a lot of things that go into the people rejecting this MBTA Communities Act.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting, the energy, affordability, and then what I'll say is accessibility or public transportation, how there's just a, there's all these ties between the two of them, even triggers, like you said, where, you know, to get into the demonstration code, you have to have met the requirements for affordability in your community. So this, there's a whole intertwining of all this stuff. But, you know, to kind of talk about, you know, well, what are we saying when we say Newton was creatively complying, you know, they passed zoning rules that technically met the requirements of the MBTA Community Act, but probably is not going to, you know, they say it can't be more than 2.5 stories, any of these buildings. So to do what they're saying, it was, doesn't economically make sense for someone to do that development.
Yep.
But they changed, but it meets the rules of the Community Act.
Right.
Right.
Well, so there is another community that also adopted it in an area that's already built out along a major thoroughfare close to the city. They said, okay, this is what we're doing. We're going to open up. And they adopted the MBTA Communities Act in an area that's pretty much built out.
Yes. And it says you can do that.
Right.
Right. And but again, like, so all these are like, hey, we're meeting the letter of the law, but not really the intent of the law. And then there's the other communities that are just saying, nope, we're not going to comply with that. And it was interesting, the Attorney General sent out a letter, or sent out a couple memos basically saying, if you don't comply, we're coming after you.
I think they did with
Milton. Yeah, they did.
They went after Milton.
Yeah, they're suing Milton.
In a suit.
And what it says is if you don't comply, you'll not be able to receive certain funding.
Yeah.
From, I don't know if it's state or federal funding. I would guess it would be state because that's the, it's a state law and they would have control over that, but maybe they have control over federal dollars as well. But yeah, and there's more votes to come, so it's going to be interesting. But the Attorney General, even before people didn't adopt this, she was sending the message that we can comply, because if not, we're coming, you know, we're going to go after you and make you comply. And I think, honestly, if enough cities and towns don't, I think the state will probably get a heavier hand in this. I think what they were saying is, hey, we want you to do this. We're going to give you some autonomy as a city and town, and here's the rule. You do it. And I think if enough cities and towns push back, I think the opposite's going to happen, which is they're going to say, okay, well, we're just going to make this much stricter and force it on you. And I think that's where we're going. And, you know, Mike, to your point, a lot of this stuff is trends we're seeing nationally with state mandated, you know, banning things like banning of single family zoning, things like that. So that's kind of the direction this is going. So it'll be interesting to see where it all plays out.